Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another exciting episode we have here of Suspense Radio. I am your host, John Robb. Pleased to have everyone that's joining us today on the show. 90 minutes, exciting shows coming up today. First off, we're going to kick it with Teresa Argy and Eric Olsen and their book, In a Perfect Halloween Theme, of course, America's Most Haunted. We're then going to switch over to author David Bell to talk about The Forgotten Girl, and we're going to end it out with author Mark Bacon and his book, Death in a Nostalgia City. So sit back, relax, and enjoy, because here you go. 90 minutes of Suspense Radio starts right now.
Welcome to my nightmare. I think you're gonna like it. I think you're gonna feel you belong.
So again, everybody, welcome back here to the show. We are excited to have our guest on today. We are going to kick it off right now with the writing team of Teresa Argy and Eric Olsen and their book, America's Most Haunted, The Secrets of Famous and Paranormal Places. So, Eric and Teresa, thank you guys so much for coming on today. How are you guys doing?
Good, doing good.
We are super funky fresh well.
Never quite heard that quite used before on the radio. So, well, this is a perfect theme. And the good thing is, of course, when Halloween comes up, everybody starts talking ghost stories, and everybody wants to know about ghost stories, and October is that kind of big month. But you guys have written a book here that is very well, I mean, it's very detailed, and it's very cool. America's Most Haunted, The Secret of Famous Paranormal Places. So the first question I'm just going to throw out to both of you is, how was the, you know, collaboration come together? How did this book kind of come together? And, you know, what kind of insight can you kind of let everybody know about the book?
Teresa, go for it.
Well, I met Eric shortly after the Haunted Housewives did an episode of Paranormal Challenge. That was a show that Zach Bagans was producing and hosting on the Travel Channel. And Eric saw our episode, which was done at Waverly Hills, and reached out and contacted me about doing an interview for the Morton Report. And me and Kathy Weber, that's my Haunted Housewives partner, we invited him to come and meet us in person, and we actually took him on a little paranormal investigation and kind of showed him what it is we do. But it was just a real light way, just kind of to introduce him to what we do. And after that, Eric and I just started talking, and we decided we wanted to start a project together, and we started a radio show, and that eventually led to the book. And that's the quick and dirty version.
And so, you know,
it's
and
not
so,
that
Eric,
dirty.
Yeah. Well, I mean, dirty's not bad. That might be for another radio show, but we do like dirty. I'm not going to say that. But so, Eric, so now, kind of, you know, your kind of involvement in the project.
Yeah, I, again, going for the shorter version of it, I had been pretty, I guess, paranormally attuned is probably the best way to put it, when I was younger, in my teens and very early 20s, and I had some rather vivid and striking and to me at the time anyway, alarming paranormal experiences. In retrospect, I didn't know this at the time, of course, I believe as I was kind of entering my young adulthood and going out into the world and graduating college and whatnot, that subconsciously I kind of just turned it off because I didn't want to deal with it. And okay, I'm an adult now. I'm going out into the real world, getting married. I got married just, you know, a year out of college. And so I just didn't want to deal with it. And honestly, I didn't. I really kind of, I did not have any particular experiences, at least that I can remember. I didn't even really have an episode of the chills or anything like that for many, 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 many years. And the way I got back into it, as Teresa mentioned, I was running and editing and writing for the Morton Report at the time, which was kind of the, I guess, third in a succession of websites that I was publishing and running and writing for. And what had happened a little before I became familiar with Teresa and saw that episode of Paranormal Challenge is we had been in Arizona for Thanksgiving, and the kids, two younger kids, were young then, and they were finally got to sleep. And we were literally just flipping through the dial, what's on, hey, what's going on? And we came across Ghost Adventures that I had no idea there even was such a thing out there, you know, that even existed.
Right.
I mean, here they are doing these investigations, and not only is it possible within the framework of the show that they would come across some sort of ghost paranormal activity, but they were expecting it, and we were just enthralled and kind of amazed and stunned, and we started watching it. This is my wife and I started watching that, and we found out about some of the other shows, Ghost Hunters and whatnot, and started watching those. So I started covering them just because I was interested, and I thought the implications of all this were really quite fascinating in that if any of this is real, one episode, one paranormal experience is real, then the implications for life after death are staggering. So we watched them. I started covering them, started interviewing them. And to kind of finish it off, those stories all did really well. They got a lot of traffic. I realized, wow, there's a ton of interest in this. And that led me to watching Paranormal Challenge. I was covering that show, and that's how I met Teresa.
And Teresa, to go back to you here, because you had mentioned, of course, the Haunted Housewives, and some people might not exactly know exactly what that is, but you said, you know, with Kathy Weber, your co-host of that, how did that kind of come about? I mean, how did you kind of, you know, I mean, I think the name is really cool. So how was your kind of experience? How did you start off becoming, you know, I guess you want to say 50% of the Haunted Housewives?
Well, I've always had a fascination with the paranormal, with many people in the field really have. It started at a very young age, and it was something that, at least in my generation, when I was younger, it wasn't something that you spoke about or could admit to readily, unless it was around Halloween time. And I was raised in a very strict religious background, and also I was told that it was a cult and I shouldn't be messing with it. So it wasn't anything that I really embraced as a younger person. But as I got older and as the internet started to come on the scene, and I met other people who were interested in the paranormal, and then, of course, the first ghost hunting shows, and for me, the first ghost shows were like In Search Of and things like that, not Ghost Hunters. That came a little bit later. But as that all developed, it became more acceptable to talk about it in public. So I started doing investigations probably in official investigations probably in 2004, 2005. Before then, I was just kind of exploring on my own. And I met Kathy Weber, and I was working with another team, and they had done a fundraiser with Kathy, and I thought, well, that's really interesting to combine fundraising and the paranormal. Yeah. And so I met Kathy, and she was a historian and a storyteller, and she had just written a book called Haunted Willoughby, Ohio. And I thought it was fascinating, and she had a ghost walk, and I went on the ghost walk with her, and I was trying to convince her to start working with me. So I basically stalked her until she agreed to start working with me, because at that point, she's like, I'm a storyteller, I'm a historian, I am not a ghost hunter. And I changed her mind very quickly once I showed her all the fascinating things that could happen. And she was the ghost lady, and I was the haunted housewife. And I had been teaching classes and giving tours and things like that under that moniker for years. And when we started working together, we became the haunted housewives. And, you know, one thing led to another. I did one reality show called The Marriage Rep, and then Paranormal Challenge came about, and it just kind of snowballed from there. So we have been actively investigating as the Haunted Housewives for a few years now. So, and we are very focused on historical places and doing fundraisers for places that maybe need the attention, they need the funding. So that is more so than the residential. We don't do residential so much anymore. We really try to work as a para-fundraising organization where we put on public hunts and raise awareness and monies for these places.
Well, we have a little bit of connection here just because I'm originally from Columbus, Ohio, and my sons actually live in Painesville and went to school in Willoughby Hills. So I'm very familiar with that, with that area. And I found it fascinating when, of course, in the book, one of the first places that, you know, you talk about is Willoughby Coal, and it's a haunted hardware store in Willoughby, Ohio. So I guess the question is, how did you kind of come about making, you know, these are the places that we're going to put in the book? How did that happen?
Well, when we first got the agent and got the book deal, different publishers wanted different things. And
sure.
What I did not want to do was do a catalog of haunted places, because that's been done and done and done and done to death. And I have several of those on my bookshelf. So we wanted to do something a little bit different. So we started with 100 places, and these are places that I chose because I was the one who actually did the ghost hunting and had been to these places. So Eric kind of left it to me to decide which ones to do. So we went from 100, we knocked it down to 50. I think we had it down to 23 at one point. And then when we signed with Penguin, they were like, we don't care if you just do 10, if you do 10 really good in-depth investigations. So we chose the 10. A lot of it was places that I had had profound experiences at, but we did need something else. We wanted some sort of twist, something different about where we found. So these places all had to have something in their history that made them a little bit more interesting. We're looking for an unsolved murder, maybe an urban legend that we could either prove or debunk, some sort of mystery, some unknown factor to give it that extra twist. And I also wanted to make sure we put at least one or two unknown places in. Cole was the unknown, and then we had one in there that's relatively unknown, and that's the Knickerbocker.
And the one, now, one of that's in the book, and I want to remind everybody that we're speaking here with authors Teresa Argy and Eric Olson. The book is called America's Most Haunted, the Secrets of Famous Paranormal Places. Now, the website is americas-most-haunted.com. The dash is there right between, you know, sandwiched in between most. So one of the ones that comes up, of course, when people watch the show Ghost Adventures, and that's the one with Zach, and I forget the other two guys, but Zach is like the head of that show, was the Bobby Massey's Music World. I mean, that's where, like, the evilness, I remember watching that episode, actually, and just knowing that the evilness, I think that's where something might have come home with one of them, or one of them got scratched up and this and that. So let's talk about when you're in a place that is probably familiar to a lot of readers that have watched the show. When you first walk into a place like that, do you have any expectations? Do you have anything kind of going in just because you've known about it from other shows or people, other people doing it? Or do you just have to walk in with a fresh mind and say, I know nothing about it, and let's see what happens?
Well, first of all, we have to know something about it or we wouldn't even be there. So the reputation usually draws us in there to the beginning. But what I found in all the years I've been doing this is any place can be haunted and any place can reportedly be haunted, but that doesn't mean there's going to be activity all the time. Bobby Mackey's was actually one of the places that we weren't sure we were going to put in the book. And because honestly, I frankly didn't believe the stories that I heard. I thought that they were all too fantastical. I thought that they were just over-exaggerated. And when I talked to people who had been there, it was about 50-50 with people said that it's so haunted, they never want to go back again, and others that say absolutely nothing happened. It was completely dead. Nothing scary happened. So Eric and I actually went down there to do a little research and interviews, and we hadn't decided we were going to put it in the book. So I really didn't have any expectations because I was kind of leaning towards not putting it in there. And just spending a few hours here changed my mind. So, you know, you have to have knowledge of the place, but I don't have any expectations because, again, I mean, any place can be haunted, and just because somebody says it's haunted doesn't mean that things are going to happen. So,
part of what we were trying to achieve, one of the key goals of the book, was to try to assess the real world reality of the various tales and legends associated with each of these places. All of these places have stories attempting to identify the supposed active spirits there, and that was something, of course, we were trying to tell. So on the one hand, we wanted to tell in story form. We wanted to do a real good job with the writing and to tell the stories kind of as they are currently being related at these places. But then to really try to research historically and on site wherever possible, to try to figure out, okay, so is there a basis in reality, in historical fact, for these stories? Is there anything we can find that supports or debunks them? And that was a lot of the fun, one of the really fun aspects of doing the book, is it was very surprising, it was very unpredictable. Some of the stories we thought, you know, no way, that's just a tale,
right,
that's a legend. We did find historical proof for supporting, and then others that we took kind of at face value, they sounded plausible, there wasn't. We couldn't find anything at all. And so it was an interesting combination, and it was a kind of a surprise at each corner as we were doing this research, and that was a lot of the fun because, as Teresa said earlier, kind of a real key focus of what she does as a paranormal investigator, rather than going for the thrills, the chills, or even the evidence per se, is they're very keen on the historical aspect of it. They are truly para-historians. So we wanted to convey that, and that, of course, was as a journalist and as a media person, that was of great interest to me, too, is to try to get all this sorted out. So I think we were able to achieve that pretty well, and there are some surprises. In fact, one of the recurring themes of the reviews of the book thus far has been, hey, you may think you know these places because most of them are quite well known. Probably 7-8 out of the 10 are acknowledged super haunts. But we really did want to, you know, tell these tales and get behind it. And people recognize, readers have and reviewers have recognized that there are surprises. And that's that was another thing we've been really happy to see people responding to. Hey, these aren't just the same old tales over and over again. You think you know these places. There are surprises in this book.
Yeah, that's the one thing that always fascinates me. And I'm glad that you guys are kind of bringing that up, is that, you know, there are some times when you go into these places and nothing happens. I mean, there's not always ghosts on display. I'm very much a believer in the paranormal. I very much believe that there's things that are outside of, you know, the normal plane, I guess, of just normal life and living. So the thing that you're able to do is you're able to go in and say there's different things happening at different times. And what was one of the one thing, I guess, that surprised you when you're talking about surprises in any place in the book that you can talk about, that you like to talk about?
Well, again, like Bobby Mackey's was surprising because I really didn't expect anything to happen, and I had something very profound happen. I actually saw a shadow figure, and it doesn't happen as often as people think. I mean, these television shows make you think that things happen all the time, and unfortunately,
right,
like Ghost Hunters, when the Ghost Hunters shows first came out, I thought it was great, because half the time they'd go to these places and nothing would happen, you know, because that's the reality of it, is you can spend hours, if not days, inside supposedly haunted location, and nothing will happen. Or you can walk in, and within the first 5 minutes, you're overwhelmed. So I don't, and again, as Eric said, our goal, the Haunted Housewives' goal, is not to get evidence. We are not trying to prove the existence of ghosts. I am not trying to change anybody's mind about believing. We have been recently accused of being snake oil salesmen trying to rip people off. And by what? I'm not proving, I'm not trying to prove anything. I'm not trying to change anyone's mind, and I never would ever in a million years claim that anything that I do is scientific, because it's not. I am focusing on the history, and I'm focusing on the experience. So when I walk into a place, I don't need to have cameras set up and meters going off to capture that, although it really would have been nice when I did see this shadow figure at Bobby Mackey's and I tried to take a picture. It would have been great if it did turn out, just not even to prove to anybody, but, you know, maybe just to show Eric or to show Kathy or somebody. But, again, if you go in trying to catch a ghost or prove the existence of the afterlife, it's not going to work, because anybody can show me the best video, the best picture, the greatest EVP, and unless I was there, or unless this is somebody that I know and trust, I'm probably not going to believe that it happened, because anything can be faked. But you can't fake an experience. You can convince yourself something happened, but you can't fake it. So we're, again, about the story, the history, and the experience, because there are surprises out there. We were so surprised to find during our research that half these things that we believed about these places weren't true. The urban legends behind Tala, the urban legends behind the Lent Mansion, the urban legends behind the Queen Mary. There's no base, even Bobby Mackey's. There was very little, if any, basis in fact for the stories that supposedly fuel the hauntings at those places. But they're still very, very paranormally active and very haunted. So it was fascinating.
Eric, do you have anything to add on that one?
Yeah, sure. We had some very interesting, vivid experiences. We kind of did the locations. We researched and investigated and wrote up the places kind of one by one. So it was a sequential sort of thing. And we started off with the Ohio State Reformatory because we were pretty positive that we wanted to include that, you know, if nothing else, this one will be included. And that was actually what we used, the chapter that we used for the actual book proposal. So that we did first. Then we did the Knickerbocker. So, I mean, we wrote up the ones that were local and really familiar, most familiar to us early on, other than Willoughby Cole, which was kind of added, I think that was added last, because we were still kind of focused on the big picture, the national picture, and we were thinking that probably the Knickerbocker, which isn't far from us, that's only about an hour away or so, it's just right across the Pennsylvania border, pretty much due east from Cleveland. And so Willoughby Cole was, okay, we got nine, we're sure we have those, and we added that last. Once we did, it became obvious that it should be in there. Once we wrote it up and added in all the stories and even the history and the background, which is also really fascinating about Willoughby Cole, then we realized, yeah, no question, this fits. And on top of it all, it's kind of the headquarters of the Haunted Housewives, so that made that much more sense. But I would say for me personally, I had the most... My eyes were probably open the most at the least intimidating, least threatening place, and that's the Knickerbocker. So that was early on. That was only the second place that we were going to. I had some very interesting experiences just wandering around by myself in the daytime at the Ohio State Reformatory. I went down a few times, and one time by myself because Teresa couldn't make it, and it was middle of the day, and they just, all right, we're busy, we can't talk to you right now, we got stuff going on, but you can just go in and wander around. Well, that was very interesting and strange, because in the daytime, especially when you're in the, there's two big main huge cell blocks, and they're massive. They go up, I think, 5 stories, and
right.
maybe one even goes up 6 stories. And they're a, you know, self-contained framework, metal frame that's the, you know, the walkways for each of these, and they're kind of rickety the higher up you go.
Right.
But other than the being kind of, you know, falling apart in terms of the paint coming off and being rather decrepit, because there's windows, there's really a whole wall of windows that faces the cells. And
wow.
the result of that, you know, it's not that creepy in the daytime because it's pretty well lit. But here I was walking around by myself in this relatively well-lit place, and it's really big, and I had lots of kind of little things happen. It's all the sort of cliches about seeing movement out of the corner of your eye and seeing shadows that shouldn't necessarily be there. You know, if I'm there by myself, I know there's no one else around. There's no animals present, you know. So what could be moving? What could be causing it? I don't know. I don't want to absolutely say that it was paranormal, but it was very strange and became, of course, very creepy. And then, you know, you can go down kind of into the bowels of the building, and I'm wandering around by myself, getting down finally into the basement, which is where, which is certainly the creepiest area of the building. That's where solitary confinement was. There's been many, many, many experiences, strange things down there, which are included in the book. But so I had kind of ill-defined but very definite paranormal feelings at the reformatory. But again, you kind of expect it because it's this huge
right.
old place. It's hulking from the outside. It certainly looks like, you know, Dracula's castle,
yeah.
which was one of the nicknames that it was given. But here we go then next to the Knickerbocker, where it's a very homey, very well decorated. That's what the owner that's kind of her thing, is that she decorates each room very meticulously and from a different decade, representing the time when the hotel was open to the public and people were coming through, which was in the later 1800s and into the, I guess, mid-1900s. And she's particularly fond of that Victorian era. So, but you go in here and it's very well decorated. It's very warm. It's very friendly. You don't really pick up a negative vibe. The basement does, again, it's part of it, I'm sure, is the creep factor. But, you know, the basement seems to be kind of the creepiest area. But again, while I was walking through, you know, things kind of were going on. And I had very strange feelings. I had it kind of felt like different levels of vibration were going on as I was walking through there. And then the thing that just slammed it home for me, two things, and those were evidence, and that, so that's very rare. They weren't personal experiences. When I saw, because I looked at it there in while I was in the building, when I saw the video of a shadow figure up on the top floor, it could not have been more specific, more vivid. And either there was a person who was casting that shadow, and we were able to kind of debunk the possibility of it being a person because just the angles were all wrong. And
right.
this was a very extended episode. This is like a minute on video. So, I mean, it's just an amazing, amazing. It's probably for me personally, other than a few of the things I've seen on TV, this was the most compelling, you know, ghost video
yeah.
I've ever seen. So that's in the Knickerbocker, and then the other
See,
thing.
See, I don't know. I don't know what I would do is if I saw something like that. I think I would probably. I don't know. I might run out of the house. I don't know. I mean, that's something that's had to experience. So I would kind of. I don't know. I would kind of probably panic a little bit, but. You know, I guess. But when you're in there looking, who knows? I don't know. It'd be a really different experience, and I think that's great. The problem that I have now is that I'm up against the time, and I could talk for hours on this subject, and I just want to thank both of you guys for coming on. I mean, it's been fascinating. I mean, just sitting here and listening, I mean, the book is outstanding, and I want to thank both of you for putting it together. And again, I want to thank both of you guys for coming on and talking, because the subject is fascinating, and thank you guys so much.
Well,
Our
thanks
pleasure.
For having us. We appreciate
yeah.
it, and Yeah, I hope everybody gets a chance to look at the book and you know, see
Absolutely.
For yourself, decide for yourself if this makes your top 10.
Absolutely.
As far as contacting us, which is, of course, always, hey, look, man, we're mercenaries. You did mention
right.
the website, and we appreciate that, but the website has been relatively low-key activity just for the last, I don't know, even 6 weeks, I guess, just because we have been so focused on the release of the book. But where we're
yep.
extremely active, and you can get a hold of us essentially round the clock or close to it and instantaneously, is through social media. And on Twitter, we're at AM Haunted, and Facebook is also AM Haunted. And that's a really great way to reach us and interact with us.
Fabulous. All right, guys. Enjoy. Thank you so much for coming on, and we will talk with you later.
Thank you.
Thank
All
you.
Right, bye-bye.
Bye.
So, again, everybody, that is authors Teresa Argy and Eric Olson, the book America's Most Haunted. You go to americas-most-haunted.com for more information. And then, like they said, you go to AM Haunted, Facebook AM Haunted, for a lot more information and interact back and forth with the authors. We're going to take a short 1 minute break kind of here. We're going to get with our next author, David Bell. So hold on to your hats. Here we go.
Join Stephen King, Peter Straub, Ellen Datlow, Ramsey Campbell, Jonathan Mayberry, and hundreds more in the Horror Writers Association's campaign, HorrorSelfies.com. Take a selfie with any written message promoting reading or with your favorite book. Check in at HorrorSelfies.com to submit your photo, and you can win signed books. Help us let the world know why horror is important and submit your selfie today. That's www.horrorselfies.com.
So again, everybody, we're back. We're taking a really short break. We want to thank, like I said, Teresa and Eric for coming on, and they kind of butted up here to the time. So we're not going to stop. We're just going to keep going. I know you guys like to hear me talk. And our next guest here is best-selling and award-winning author David Bell. His book is called The Forgotten Girl. I mean, he has gotten some fabulous reviews from his books, and this, of course, is no different, with Nelson DeMille and Linwood Barclay and J.T. Ellison all chiming in. So, David, we want to thank you so much for coming on. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me on.
And this is the first time we were able to speak with you on the radio. I believe I know that we interviewed you for the magazine at one time back, so it's great to finally be able to talk to you and talk about your book here, The Forgotten Girl, which I like what Nelson DeMille says in there. He, you know, in his review, you know, he says it's a mystery lover's mystery. And that's kind of what, you know, you've been able to kind of put together with the book. So can you kind of give us a little behind-the-scenes look of The Forgotten Girl and what exactly it's about?
Yes, absolutely. The Forgotten Girl is the story of a guy named Jason Danvers. He's middle-aged. He's moved back to his hometown, and he's haunted by a couple of people who have disappeared from his life. On his high school graduation night, he got into a fight with his best friend, and that night the best friend left town and no one has seen him again. So he's always kind of wondered what happened to my friend that night. And then his sister, Hayden, has had a lot of substance abuse problems, and he's been estranged from her for about 5 years. So at the beginning of the book, someone knocks on his door, and it's his sister Hayden, who he has not laid eyes on in 5 years. And she shows up at his door, and she says, "Hey, I'm back in town. I'm clean and sober, and I have something I have to do here, but I'm not going to tell you what it is." And so this begins the process of Jason discovering what really happened to his friend that night, and what does his sister know about it? So all of these things that he thought he understood to some extent, he finds out it's not what everybody thought at all, and all of this stuff unravels right before him.
So when you're sitting down, and the big thing right now, of course, is going on is series standalones and all these things going on. And, you know, it's like half and half. Half the office doing series, half the office doing standalones. I've always been a standalone guy for some reason, I guess if you had to pick sides, because I like the idea of sitting in front of the blank canvas, and you have to create everything from scratch again. Every book is ground zero for you. So when you're thinking about that and you're thinking about the plot and your character, what is kind of the, you know, the chicken before the egg? You know, is it the characters that you're kind of wanting to explore more, or is it a subject matter and plot that you're wanting to explore more? How is your kind of creativeness, you know, brought out when you're penning a new book?
Yeah, I think it always has to start with a character for me. I think when people think about thrillers and mysteries, they think about the plot. They make an assumption that thrillers and mystery stories are all about the plot and characters are secondary. But I disagree with that. I think any good story has to begin with characters, because characters are the ones who determine the plot. If you had a different character, you'd have a different plot because somebody would make different choices. So for me, it's always about a character. It's about a character in a certain situation. And from there, it's really, I mean, this is the great thing about being an author. It's sort of like when you're a kid and, you know, you play make-believe and you play with your action figures or whatever. Being an author is like you're an adult who gets to play make-believe. You say, what if there was a guy, what if there was a woman, and they were in this situation, what would happen? What would happen next? What would happen after that? So for me, it's always a character with a certain problem, and then where is that going to go? And then by the end of the book, how has that character changed? What has been the result of all of these things for this character at the end? They've got to be somewhere different. They've got to learn something. They've got to have discovered something. Doesn't have to be something good. It doesn't have to be a positive change, but they get to the end and something is different for the reader and for the character.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of a great way to put it, because a lot of the things, you know, are character-driven, and that's the other kind of debate. You know, people always say, is it the plot-driven or the character-driven? I always find all those kinds of debates fascinating when people are talking about them. And, and it always comes down to one thing, which, of course, is just write a good story and, you know, and just make it interesting. And that's the thing that you've been able to do here with, you know, with your books and becoming very, very successful. And there's really no written formula. I'm sure people are, you know, always asking you, oh, you know, how did you do it and blah, blah, blah. Well, there's really no secret formula for it, or else everybody would do it, right? It's just hard
work. I also think that no two writers do it the same way. I mean, I could sit here and say, well, this is how I think of a story. You could talk to the next writer and they would say, oh, no, I don't do that. I do it this way. I mean, no two writers function the same way. No two writers discover the story the same way. So really it does come down to, if someone is a writer and they're trying to figure out what to do, they just have to figure out what works for them. I mean, do they write better in the morning? Do they write better at night? Do they work with an outline? Do they not work with an outline? All those things, that's all part of the process of discovery for someone as they're making their way through this thing.
Yeah, I mean, and the one thing about the book here in Forgotten Girl is when you have family aspect, like, of course, when you have, you know, Jason, and then you have his younger singer, you know, sister Hayden, and the emotions that they had to go through, and of course with her addictions and everything, and then all of a sudden, you know, she's thrusting her daughter onto them to say, you know, can you watch, and then she's kind of gone. So now you have a lot of emotions that are all working themselves together within the book, and how are they all going to play out?
Yeah, I mean, I think
complicated. I mean, how challenging is that for you?
Well, I think families, you know, I write a lot about families just because being in a family is a universal experience. I mean, we're all in some kind of family. So that's a universal experience that we've all had. All families are different, of course, but there are things that we all experience. We all know what it's like to have relationships with our parents. Unless you're an only child, you know what it's like to have a sibling relationship. And so I think that's something that people can relate to. I think it's something that families are the place in our lives where we experience great deal of love, great deal of comfort, great deal of familiarity, great deal of support. Mm-hmm. But let's face it, even in the best families, families are also the places where we experience great frustration, anger, things that happen in our families stay with us the rest of our lives. So that's kind of why I like to dig into families, because there is so much drama, there's so much character just built into the experience of a family that I just love exploring that. And I think there are an unlimited number of stories you can tell about families.
Yeah, and, you know, of course, we're coming up to the holiday season, and that's either the most stressful time or the most happy time during families when they all kind of get together, you know, Thanksgiving and Christmas. You just never kind of know what's going to happen, and it always makes for an interesting reality show in a lot of households because, hey, you know, I mean, a lot of them are tinderboxes. I mean, a lot of things are waiting to explode. And the one aspect of the book that fascinated me, of course, was when you go back, 20-some years later, I think it was 28-5 or 27 years later, and what happened previous, and now kind of moving things forward, it is kind of that mystery wrapped up in that enigma that you, because now the reader is kind of thrust to say, well, God, what happened back then, and how is it kind of moving itself forward now, and exactly what's going on with all the moving parts? So is it challenging for you when you're having to do that, when you're saying, okay, this is what happened in the past, now we're moving it into forward, but now you kind of bring all that kind of together and kind of meet in the middle?
Yeah, sometimes I have to write things down and remember, like, you know, oh, this is what happened in the past, and this was the relationship then, and this is how it relates to what's going on now. And I think I write a lot about the past because, and I'm not saying anything that most people don't know, but the past is always with us. I mean, the things that happened in the past, especially things, in the case of the Forgotten Girl, things that happened to the characters in high school are things that stay with them for a long time. I mean, we never forget things that happened in high school. We never forget the people we were close to in high school. That's kind of what this is about, is, you know, this guy's middle-aged, and so he's, and this happens to all of us in life. We can be really close to people at a certain time in our life, like in high school and college, you spend all this time with these people. And then people go their own way. You graduate, you move away, you get jobs, you have kids, you do all that stuff. And then all of a sudden, at some point, you look back and say, wow, you know, it's been years since I've seen that person. For a time in my life, they were the most important person in the world to me. And now, you know, I don't see them that much anymore. I don't know what they're doing. We have Facebook now, so, like, sometimes people pop up out of the past. Sometimes there are people you don't want to pop up out of the past. You know, when they show up on Facebook. Yeah. But I think that was kind of one of the impulses behind writing the story was, what's it like when you've kind of lost touch with people, but you haven't really forgotten them? And in some ways, people remain frozen in our minds where they were when we saw them the last time. So if you knew somebody in high school, you haven't seen them since high school, you think, oh, well, they must be the same as they were in high school, even though I'm different, but we tend to think of people freezing at that point. Then when you encounter them again, it's kind of like, whoa, you're a different person and I'm a different person, and all these things have changed, even though we went through these intense experiences 25, 27 years ago.
Yeah, and, you know, and 27 years ago, of course, we're just in the late 80s, 87, you know, 86, 87, there was, you know, cell phones were not widely used. Of course, you know, computers were much different than they are today, no social media, things like that. So you're having to write about stuff that's going on in the 80s. You know, of course, you had the 80s metal, you know, the big hair, and then rap was coming up, so the music even was different. The, you know, the culture was different. And then, of course, fast forward to 2014, it's a totally different kind of, you know, dynamic that's going on. So you're colliding kind of two decades, you know, the 80s, 70s, and 80s decades people think are, you know, the greatest for music and some of the big cultural changes that happened in our country. And then now 2014, where it's a totally different dynamic that's going on. So how cool is that to kind of be able to write those things? But, I mean, and also, I mean, it's kind of interesting to see just within your book how the world has changed so fast and rapidly just from what's going on.
Well, I think the 80s were the best time for music because that's when I was in high school, and that's the last time I was cool about music. I teach at a university, so I'm around a lot of young people all the time, and sometimes they'll say, like, hey, what kind of music do you listen to? And I'll say, you know, Well, you know, the last time I was cool with music was pretty much 1989 when I bought like a Cocteau Twins, you know, tape, you know, back then. That was the last time I was cool. So I get that. It's an interesting challenge, I think, for somebody who wants to write thrillers, because 27 years ago, people could disappear and go off the grid and you would never hear from them again. And no one would think that was weird because you had no way to look someone up unless you found a phone book or something like that.
Yeah.
But now,
the
phone book is the thing they throw on your porch in that plastic bag that kind of sits out there for weeks and weeks.
For a week.
No one does anything
like,
with it.
Yeah, you feel like it's too heavy to bring inside.
Or you just end up throwing it right in the recycling bin, I guess.
Right.
But now, you know, if somebody disappears or goes out of your life, there are all these tools, you know, with which we can find people, whether it's Facebook or just like a people search online.
Yeah.
You know, like every place is offering like background checks and searches and current addresses. So it's a little more of a challenge to get rid of people now than it was 25 years ago, I think.
So in the book, The Forgotten Girl, and again, we're speaking here with author David Bell, and you can go to davidbellnovels.com for more information, but the book is The Forgotten Girl. It is out now, came out a couple weeks ago. So give us that character in the book. You know, there's always that one character I always like to ask authors that has surprised you, gave you more of a surprise than you thought originally than they may have, would have at the beginning when you started writing. Who is that character for you?
Well, I'll say this. I won't give too much away about the book, but when people do read the book, there's a character who shows up, I guess he shows up about halfway through the book. His name is Jesse Dean. And he is a surprising character in the book. I think when people first meet him, they're going to have one impression of him. And then when they read through to the end of the book, they're going to have a very different impression of this guy. It's a complex impression of this guy. And I think that's one of the exciting things about writing is when, because for instance, I didn't necessarily know what he was going to be doing at the end of the book when I started writing. So it's a surprise to me how that character changed and developed. And I think it'll be a surprise for the reader as well. And that's one of the cool things about writing thrillers and probably about writing anything is that as an author, I can be surprised by the story as well, and I can be surprised by a character. And I think everybody reads thrillers partially for that experience, that you get to the end of the book and you say, I did not see that coming. I did not see that character changing in the way that he changed, and I did not know it was going to be this person who did this thing at the end of the book. So that's a guy I would look for as people read the book, is Jesse Dean. He was the guy who really surprised me.
Yeah, that's interesting. And that's kind of neat that you know, all of a sudden he kind of shows up halfway through the book and has that big of an impact. You know, that's something that's not really seen too much, and it's probably difficult to do, is to all of a sudden, you know, you build up these storyline going forward, and all of a sudden, bam, you know, you're introducing this character that has such a tremendous impact halfway through.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that I think readers look for, that readers start reading a book, and they get settled into the world. You know, maybe you read about 100 pages, and you get settled into the world, and the reader is thinking to themselves, all right, I got this all figured out. I've got this landscape figured out. I know who's doing what. I know what the relationships are. And then whether it's a new piece of information or a new character or some new revelation, it kind of like you reshuffle the whole deck a third of the way and say, oh, wait a minute, everything I thought I knew is gone. Now I have to create a new set of expectations. And then another, you know, 50, 100 pages, that may happen again. I think that's – readers are really smart. Readers who read a lot of thrillers – are really smart, and they know the tricks, and they've read a lot. So I think writers today who are writing thrillers and mystery stories really have to work hard, really have to be on their toes to keep the readers guessing, because the readers are so sophisticated and read so much. So that's always the challenge. It's almost a chess match between the writer and the reader, and saying, can I really do something that's going to surprise this really experienced reader who's read tons of thrillers and they know all the things that are going to happen. If I can surprise those people, then I've really done my job well.
And, you know, looking back into your first book, Cemetery Girl, and now going through, you know, The Hiding Place and Never Come Back, and now you're into The Forgotten Girl, how do you think that you have changed as an author now through, you know, four books? And if you look back in Cemetery Girl and you're like, wow, I can't believe I wrote that. Because now you're so much, I mean, you know, because your writing style might have changed it, and maybe you've polished things that, you know, you didn't quite have down back then. So how have you kind of changed as an author?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think it's always a challenge. You were talking at the beginning about the standalone versus the series. I think it's true of anything, whether it's a series or a standalone. Every time a writer sits down to start a new project, whether it's a story or a book, even maybe a new chapter, it's daunting. I mean, it's daunting to look at that blank word processing file and say, I've got to fill this up. I mean, it feels almost like it's starting over every time, like you're, you know, like I've never written a book before. I don't know anything. I'm at zero, and I'm starting over as a kindergartner trying to figure this thing out. It can feel that way sometimes. Mm-hmm. So that hasn't changed. The only thing that the more books I publish and the better things go, you know, I've got a little bit of experience and confidence to fall back on. In other words, if I were writing a first book and I'd never written a novel or never published a novel before, I would say, I don't know if I can do this. You know, this is totally new. I don't know if I can do this. When I'm sitting down to write something now, I can say, well, you know, I have done this before. If I could do it before, I can do it again. So maybe it's like, there's 1% or 2% or 5% in the tank that gives me a little boost to get going that I didn't have a few years ago. But it doesn't really diminish the challenges. I used to hear writers say, you know, before I had a writing career, I'd hear writers say, oh, it doesn't get any easier. You know, it's never easy. And that's absolutely true. It doesn't get any easier. There's always a challenge to create characters and write these, you know, 400 pages to get a good story going. But I can look back and say, well, I have done it before. I can probably do it again. I can probably do it again.
Now, kind of off the subject of your actual book and kind of getting into, I guess, some of the business side of it, over the past year, of course, with our magazine and our radio show, I mean, that's something that we've expanded. You know, we've tried to make bigger, we've tried to make better. We've had, you know, more radio shows now. We're looking at, you know, producing and creating two or three more going into the next to the next year, because the one thing that we feel is that there's not a lot of outlets for you guys to kind of reach people anymore. It's like things are, you know, contracting. I mean, reviews are being contracted. I mean, there's a couple magazines that used to do reviews that are no longer even going to review thrillers anymore. So it makes it more difficult for you guys. So how is that for you, besides, you know, outside of the writing part, the marketing part and getting your name out? I mean, how is that a challenge for you every time you have a new book coming out?
Yeah, it is a challenge. I mean, by the way, Suspense Magazine is a great magazine, so it's great to hear that you guys are doing more, because it's an absolutely vital magazine for this genre and really for anybody. So I'm glad to hear that.
Thank you very much.
You know, well, yeah, I'm not just shamelessly sucking up to the host of the show, by the way. I mean, you know.
But it always works. It always works.
Is there some kind of prize that I get at the end for saying that? Do I?
Well, you know, we'll give you free. We'll, you know, who knows? I mean, we'll give you some free stuff. We got some books.
Good.
You want some books? We get like $6,000 a year, so you know, I can send you a couple books.
Okay, I was thinking more like a new car, but that's okay. I'll take
Yeah.
But to answer your question, you know, sometimes I think the mistake that happens is that it feels like it's easier to reach people because of social media. It feels like, oh, heck, you know, you get on Twitter and, you know, 1,000 people read something, or you get on Facebook and 1,500 people read your post, and, like, you can have a website. And really, the website and those things are great to the extent that full readers have direct access to writers that I don't think they used to. I mean, when I was a kid, if you wanted to contact a writer. You had to write a physical letter and send it to the publisher, and maybe the publisher would get it to the writer, and on, whereas now somebody can just click on a link and say, hey, I'm sending you an email, I'm posting on your Facebook wall. So I think that's a great thing, that readers have this access to writers, writers can talk directly to readers, that's wonderful. But the mistake, I think, would be to think that it makes it any easier to really market yourself or get attention, because anybody who's been on Twitter or Facebook or one of those things just sees the mountain of information that is on there, and that you send out a tweet about, hey, my book is coming out, or I'm doing a reading or whatever, that's just one of, you know, thousands and thousands of tweets and Facebook posts and things like that that are going on. So it's still a tremendous challenge, I think, to get the word out. I mean, I think the old-fashioned things still work. You know, I think building a little name recognition, getting really good reviews. In my case, you know, benefiting from the generosity of great writers like Nelson DeMille and J.P. Ellison and Linwood Barclay and others in the past like Will Lavender and Lisa Unger, people who have given me blurbs, you know, those people don't have to do that. You know, Nelson DeMille does not have to help someone like me. You know, he's Nelson DeMille. But the fact that he takes the time and says, I'm going to help other writers who are coming along behind me, that's a tremendous thing. So I think, you know, those things that make the mystery and the thriller writer community something special are the things that help get the word out. But in the end, it's really, I think it's just the old-fashioned stuff. It's word of mouth. If somebody reads the book, they tell their friend, they read it in their book club, you know. These kinds of things, I think, do benefit a great deal with today's technology. If they post a review online, you know, they go to Goodreads, they go to BarnesandNoble.com, they go to Library Thing or Amazon, and they post a review and they share that information, that's a great way for word of mouth to spread. And I really, the one thing I have learned is I think word of mouth is the most important thing for a book catching on, whether it's reviews in a journal like yours, people in book clubs, people just talking about books. That's the way the word spreads. That's the way people learn about books.
Well, we got about a minute left here. And so what I want to do is I want to kind of give you the last word, because I know you mentioned, you know, your website and, you know, contacting. So how can then people be able to interact with you and contact you and find everything that there is going on in the David Bell world here?
Well, my website is davidbellnovels.com, and you can go on there. There are excerpts from the book. If you're in a book club, you can find out information about book clubs. And through there, you can see I'm on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. It's all David Bell Novels. So absolutely track me down there. Like my page. Let me know if you like the book. I'm always happy to respond as quick as I can and talk to people. And I think readers can understand it's a huge thrill when writers hear from readers who say they like their book. So any writer would love to hear that. So, yeah, track me down. Let me know what's going on.
All right, David. Hey, well, we want to thank you so much for coming on today. It's been such a pleasure to finally be able to talk to you. Like we said, we had you guys in the magazine, so it was great. And we wish you nothing but the best. Whatever we can do for you in the future, let us know. We're always here for you, man.
All right, John. I really appreciate you having me coming on. Thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot. You have a good one. So, again, everybody, that is author David Bell, davidbellnovels.com. The book is called The Forgotten Girl. It's out now. Wherever you buy books, you can go get it. It's a fascinating read. And like we said, the reviews that he has from Nelson DeMille to J.T. Ellison, I mean, they all say it. So it's definitely a book that should be on your bookshelf. We're going to take a short 2-minute break here. We're going to be back with our last guest of the day. He is author Mark Bacon. His book is called Death in Nostalgia City. And we'll see you on the other side. Hold on.
I pretend you still
So welcome back, everybody, here after the break. First, we just want to thank our guests for being on, Teresa Argy and Eric Olson, talking about their book, America's Most Haunted, and then, of course, we just had David Bell on. But now we want to transition into our last guest of the show. He is author Mark Bacon. His book is called Death in Nostalgia City, a very interesting title, and we want to welcome Mark to the show. So, Mark, thanks so much for coming on. How you doing?
I'm doing good, John. Thanks for having me.
So let's just jump right in here, and let's just right go to the book, Death in Nostalgia City. Give us some behind-the-scenes look of exactly, you know, what the book is about.
Sure, be glad to. Why don't we start off with the setting, because the setting is right in the title, Death in Nostalgia City. What is Nostalgia City? First of all, let me ask you a question, and your listeners a question. Have you ever wondered what it would be like to go into a theme park after hours when the place is closed? There's no people around. The rides
absolutely
are supposed to
every time.
The rides are supposed to have been stopped, and it's pitch dark. What is that like? Actually, early in my career, I had a chance to find out exactly what that is like through a job that I had. But I'll talk about that a little bit later. Let's talk about Nostalgia City. Nostalgia City is the brainchild of Archibald Maxwell, a multi-billionaire developer. Everybody calls him Max. Max developed hotels and casinos in Las Vegas, but then he moved from Las Vegas, he moved from Nevada, and he built the world's most elaborate theme park. Nostalgia City is a theme park and resort, and the main feature of it is an entire recreation of what a small town would have looked like in the late 1960s and early 1970s, and he has spared no expense. Everything in the park is exactly as it would have been. The cars, clothes, food, hotels, stores, music, radio and TV, everything is exactly as it might have been. The park is advertised as a trip back in time, and the people that work there can't use their cell phones, they can't be listening to iPods, there's no computers in sight. It is as it used to be. And even telephones are those big clunky things that people used to have on desks with receivers with the coiled cords attached to them. The park is complete, and it's also huge. It covers several square miles, and it includes a fun zone, which has a lot of theme park rides. It also has a golf course, a dude ranch, and a cluster of hotels and restaurants. So it's really complete. In fact, it's so large that I had a map put in the front of the book. So the first, just before the first chapter of Death in Nostalgia City, is a map that shows you what the whole place looks like. As you can guess, the biggest market for this theme park would be people who remember the 60s and 70s, and that would be baby boomers and people older than that. And then by extension, the people who would be interested in the book would be that same group. But everybody can be interested in this, because even if they look at the 1960s and 70s as history, the book still has suspense, action, and lots of mysteries to solve along the way. So Nostalgia City sounds great, but this is a suspense novel, and some bad things happen. Rides are sabotaged, tourists are killed, and somebody has to figure out who is doing this, and that's where our protagonists come in.
Yeah, that's where, you know, Lyle Deming, the head of the book, kind of starts, you know, doing its thing. But, you know, you mentioned Arizona, and with all the places that, you know, of course you could have picked, why did you go ahead and pick that particular place that this is where this was to be built on?
I picked Northern Arizona for the same reason that Maxwell picked it. It's obviously big. He needed some place with inexpensive land, and there's a lot of inexpensive desert land in Northern Arizona, number one. And number two, old Route 66 travels through Northern Arizona. If you remember the words in the song, it goes through cities in Northern Arizona, and there are still remnants of Route 66 in northern Arizona that you can find. In fact, my wife and I have driven along there. So it has a tie to the past. So those two things kind of come together and makes northern Arizona just the perfect spot for this.
Yeah, I've driven out from Ohio to California a couple times, and you know, you use that Interstate 40, which was, of course, the Route 66 killer, and
right.
You see a lot of signs on Interstate 40 saying, hey, you know, get off for, you know, historic Route 66, and you can kind of jump off. And then, of course, the Disney movie Cars was big in talking about how that, you know, the interstate, of course, was the killer. And you know, we kind of do that a lot in our country, is we kill our past. For some reason, you know, let's kill it and make it bigger and better and bigger and better. But it doesn't really, I don't really get with that. So
that,
I think it's great that you're able to do that.
That's kind of an underlying theme in the book. It's not really heavy into this, but Lyle, my chief detective in here, has a lot of issues, but some of them are with his own past. And so we're talking about a past that people look at with pleasure, but we're also talking about a past that people can look at with things they remember that weren't too pleasant. And I like the term nostalgia in Death in Nostalgia City, because nostalgia can mean a lot of different things to different people. I've talked to people, when you say nostalgia, they get sort of a warm smile on their face, and other people start frowning. So there's a lot of different emotions involved in that.
Yeah, and your background kind of lends, because you mentioned, you know, how you were able to, you know, do kind of the walk behind the scenes into an amusement park, because it is one of those, you know, creepy places, I guess, at night. I mean, because you have all these kinds of things going on and all this stuff. But, you know, you originally were Southern California. You were a newspaper reporter. And you work for Knott's Berry Farms, which is big down by Anaheim and close to Disneyland. And, of course, every Halloween they turn into Knott's Scary Farms. So give us a little bit about the background and how that, you know, kind of translates into the writing here, into the book.
That's really where a lot of the nuts and bolts of the book and a lot of nuts and bolts of Nostalgia City itself came from. I worked in the advertising department at Knott's Berry Farm, which you're familiar with being in Southern California. It's a large theme park. It's just down the road from Disneyland. And they do indeed have a Knott's Scary Farm, which is probably the biggest event they have during the year. And the park, the entire theme park, turns into a giant house of horror, so to speak. And I worked there when they were doing that. I was in the advertising department, so I was writing commercials. I've always been a writer. But on occasion, I got to work in the park during the time it was open for special events. I talked to people who worked in the public areas. I got to see why decisions were made as to different special events they do, why they promoted this ride, why they didn't do this kind of a ride. And there is an incredible amount of detail that goes into a theme park, as you can probably imagine. And I got to see a lot of that firsthand, and it stuck with me. And it was years ago now, but the ideas and the things that I learned there, and walking around the park at night, and I even dressed up as a vampire one night during the Halloween haunt, even though I was a copywriter. It was a lot of fun, actually, scaring the wits out of people. But all of that sort of stuck with me, and it kind of came out when I started planning this novel and planning my ultimate theme park. The other side of my experience early on was a police reporter, and I covered a police beat every day. So I got to know a little bit about how cops think, how they work, police procedure, and so on. And putting the two of those things together created Nostalgia City. John, there's one other influence in here. These are all sort of a mixed soup in my brain that came up with the final story of Nostalgia City. But I live in Reno right now, and the largest special event here every year is called Hot August Nights. And it is a pageant to classic cars and old rock and roll. And you can be driving down any street in town, and you look in your rearview mirror, and you're just as likely to see a 57 Chevy or a 72 Camaro. Literally thousands of classic cars come to town. And I got to thinking, that this was really nice. It was kind of like reliving the past, but it wasn't really. It wasn't all the way, because it was just some rock and roll groups and these old cars and people would dress up. And I thought, well, what would it be like if you did everything as the past? I mean, everything down to the food, the music, the buildings, and everything was back from the 60s and 70s. And that's Nostalgia City. And that's where Lyle and Kate live.
Now, the thing about it is that the theme park, of course, is, you know, early 70s, late 60s theme. But
right.
The death and the suspense that goes on, of course, is all modern. So, like, I always like to talk about challenges with writers, you know, the challenging of, okay, everything that they're going to see, you know, visually is going to be that 60s and 70s. But all the stuff that has to go on and the crimes and everything else is all modern day. So what was the biggest challenge when you're kind of, you know, writing scenes that people are seeing, you know, the rotary phones on the table and those kinds of things, but having to do 2014 kinds of, you know, procedural things?
Yeah, that is really a challenge. Part of how this was solved is the same way that they solved these issues in the park, and that is they tried to keep it as pristine from 1972 as possible and didn't allow any of the outside to intrude. But unfortunately it does when things happen and the police have to come in. But even the police are kept at arm's length. Nostalgia City is in a county in northern Arizona, unincorporated area where the chief law enforcement is the sheriff's department, fairly small. And so there's a bit of animosity between the sheriff's department and the security, the in-house security at Nostalgia City. But the other aspect of the old and the new comes into play, particularly with my two protagonists. And if you'll allow me, I can tell you a little bit about each of them and how that works together.
Yeah. Oh, that was going to be my next question, was introduce us here to, you know, Maxwell and Lyle Deming. So please,
yeah.
Go ahead.
My two protagonists ultimately become detectives, but neither of them are working as detectives because they're just working at a theme park. But Lyle is a baby boomer himself, and he's familiar with the park and the past, and he uses a lot of references to old TV shows, old music, but is the person who turns out to be his partner is a little bit younger and gets frustrated by him talking about all the old stuff that really, to her, is just old stuff, not things that she remembers distinctly. Lyle is the main detective. Lyle is, well, he's an ex-cop, and he was a good cop, but he was overcome with anxiety. He took his cases far too seriously. The victims that he dealt with could never find the kind of closure that he wanted, and he realized that with his caseload, he was never going to help everybody. And so he became stressed out was his default setting. The police sent him to a therapist. He wears a rubber band on his wrist for stress therapy. The idea is you pluck the rubber band, and it snaps you back to the present, and you're not going off in your own world. But when he's really stressed, he talks to himself. He left the police department under somewhat unusual circumstances that are part of the mystery of the book, so I won't go into that. But he looks for something that's going to be a little more peaceful. As Lyle explains it, he wanted to have a job where he could talk to people because they were happy and on vacation, not because they had just seen a loved one murdered. And so he finds that job. He becomes a cab driver in a theme park, and it's this huge theme park, so a cab is really kind of handy. And he chats with tourists, and he can relax, and he's enjoying himself. Unfortunately, that doesn't last too long because this is a suspense novel.
Right.
Helping him out is his ultimate sidekick, and her name is Kate Sorensen. She is the park's PR director. And when things start turning bad at the park, she becomes extremely busy working with the news media because the news media loves to do negative stories, and when there's tragedy, they come streaming in, and they come streaming into Nostalgia City in spite of some people's efforts to keep them out. But Kate's background is entirely different, and the way she goes about life is different than Lyle. She was a college basketball player. She was a forward at USC and played scholarship for 4 years. And a lot of the life lessons that she has, she learned on the basketball court. Kate is 6 feet, 2.5 inches tall.
Yeah, no, I was going to hope you were going to say that, because you can't miss her. Let's put it that way.
Exactly. And six feet, 2.5 inches tall for a woman is a real asset in basketball, but not necessarily in the social world or in the boardroom. So she has ways to deal with that. When she teams up with Lyle, ultimately, because of the sabotage going on at the park, some of her training from basketball kicks in. And on the basketball court, when you can see the 30-second clock clicking down, you have to make decisions right away. And making quick decisions is not Lyle's strong point, and that's where Kate comes in to help him a bit.
Yeah, I mean, when people go out, and again, we're speaking here with author Mark Bacon, and the book is Death in Nostalgia City, and Mark's website is baconsmysteries.com. So make sure it's baconsmysteries.com. And when you're kind of going through it, and you know, and you're reading, you know, about the book, and that's the one thing that popped out was, you know, wow, she's 2.5. My Lord, she ain't gonna, you know, she's sure to stand out in a crowd. That I was like, you know, I'm just curious, the mindset of creating Kate and why, you know, basketball player that kind of tall, because that's something you don't see a lot in books. I mean, you know, the woman is, you know, kind of average, nothing really special.
Right.
It's more her emotional side than her physical side. So I'm just curious why, you know, why you did it that way.
Exactly. That's a good question. Actually, my daughter was a basketball player in college. She was on a scholarship, and I got a really good inside look at Division I college basketball. She played for Pepperdine, which I'm sure you're familiar with.
Yeah, just down the street.
Exactly. And Angie, my daughter, is kind of the opposite of Kate. My daughter was a guard, and she's 5'6". But she went through the same kinds of things that Kate did, only not from the taller perspective. But Angie had a lot of players on her team who were that tall, and so I knew some of those young women and got a little insight into what it's like being that tall and going through life when you really stand out. The other thing is that Kate is, as Lyle would say, drop-dead gorgeous. And fortunately, she is able to use both her strength and her looks to pull them out of a couple of desperate situations.
And just so people, you know, to have kind of a picture in your head, when you know, like when you mentioned Pepperdine, a lot of people don't realize it has got to be top 10, one of the most gorgeous campuses you will ever step foot on. And don't be scared of the deer that are all over the place, because they're just part of the population, and people just go around with them. So it's kind of a weird thing, and it's kind of cool because it is a different setting of a college campus. And it's kind of a – go ahead.
I was just going to say, basketball there is very intense, and that's where Kate brings an intensity and a focus to Death and Nostalgia City that – Lyle, who is the ex-cop, should have but doesn't.
But what I was going to say is that Pepperdine is kind of a metaphoric thing to your book, and in this kind of way, is that it is such a different campus. It's up on a cliff. You're overlooking the ocean. It's in Malibu. You got the deer around and everything else. Much different than you would see in a normal bitch college campus. And that's kind of what you've done in your book, is because you've kind of set it with different types of genres. You can't really put it in any particular one. You've wrapped them up into different things. So explain kind of how you did that with the book, because it's tough to say it's a suspense or it's a thriller, it's kind of a mystery, because you have encompassed different styles into your book.
I like to tell people that I wrote Death and Nostalgia City to be the kind of novel that I like to read. I started out, I've read mysteries for years and years and years, and I started out, perhaps like a lot of people, reading Agatha Christie, Dorothy Sayers, G.K. Chesterton, and reading what is generally called cozies. And I enjoyed those, and they were brain challenges to figure out what happened. But my taste changed after a while. Raymond Chandler, the famous noir mystery writer, never liked those kinds of mystery books. And he said that he didn't like those books because you had to wait till the very end to really get the enjoyment out of it, that the whole book was hinged on the last few pages when the detective says, the butler did it. And
right.
Chandler said that each chapter in a mystery, a suspense story, should be rewarding in itself, and it should have something going on that really is worth reading, not something that you delay your gratification with. And I agree with that. But I like both kind of books. I like the Chandler action. I like the things that tug at your brain to try to figure out. So I made Death and Nostalgia City a mystery, and there's lots of things to figure out, and it's not just one thing about who did it, but there's little things all the way along. But there's also a lot of action, and there are things that appeal not just to your head, but to your heart, because our two protagonists get in some pretty desperate situations, and you don't know what's going to happen and what's going to be done to them. And so that's the heart side. So Death and Nostalgia City has appeal to the head and appeal to the heart.
Now, we always have a lot of authors that, you know, listen to the show. And the one thing they always like to know about, of course, is the journey that you had to go on. And what I mean by that is when you wrote the end, and that's what you wrote in the book, what was now the journey to get the book published? How was it for you?
This is my first novel, but not my first book. I've written 7 books, and each one was a challenge. Each one was a life-bending experience, actually. I had different publishers. I should say that Death and Nostalgia City is published by Black Opal Books, and it's been a pleasure working with them. Each book that I've done has been kind of a different journey. Some I've worked with agents, some I haven't. It's a challenge each time, and I have gone into each one thinking it was going to be similar to the previous one, and it wasn't.
Yeah, I mean, the way that publishing and stuff has changed so much, I mean, it's very difficult. And like we were just speaking with author David Bell, I think that the hardest part now for an author is not even really writing the book, it's getting people to read the book. And so when we're kind of wrapping up here, we got about 2 minutes left in the show, kind of, how are you kind of handling that as an author? How are you kind of getting out to get more fans and more readers and more things like that to do? What are you doing?
Well, John, I think I agree with you. What you said in the previous program is that word of mouth is really about the most important. And so people, that's how I find out about a lot of books, and I think that's the way a lot of readers find out about them. So I'm talking to as many people as I can. I'm doing programs like this with you and telling everybody about Nostalgia City, Death and Nostalgia City, and that it is a mixture of a mystery and a suspense story with something of interest to baby boomers, but of anybody who likes a fast-moving mystery story. And as we said a minute ago, the books have changed so much. The first book I wrote was long before ebooks, and it was like 1995 when it came out, and you can get Death and Nostalgia City now for $3.03 on the Kindle on Amazon, which is quite a bargain, I think.
That's a nostalgia price.
Yes, exactly.
So we got about a minute left, and what I would like to do is I'd like to kind of give you the last word to kind of say anything else that we might not have touched on or that you wanted to touch on, contacting or, things that you got going on in the future. So, the last minute is kind of you to kind of get anything else out that, that you can.
To find out more about Death and Nostalgia City, I would invite everybody to visit my website. Again, it's baconsmysteries.com, and you'll find some backstory on the book. You'll see pictures, reviews, and just about anything you need to know about the book, and also all the different places that you can find to buy it. For mystery lovers who were growing up in the 60s and 70s, Death and Nostalgia City is a trip back in time, and boomers are going to find a lot of things to trigger memories. But the main purpose of Death and Nostalgia City is to follow my two detectives and solve not one but many mysteries. And one reviewer said that this book traveled at the speed of a theme park ride, and I hope everybody enjoys the journey.
Well, I want to say, Mark, I want to thank you so much for coming on today. It's been a pleasure to acquaint ourselves with you because we had not known, of course, so it was great. You know, this is one of the reasons why we do the show in the magazine is to acquaint ourselves with, you know, new authors and bring you to new fans and vice versa. So we want to thank you for coming on.
John, I appreciate the opportunity.
All right. You have a good one. And, of course, anything that we can always do for you in the future, just never hesitate. Just give us that.
Very good. Death and Nostalgia City.
Right. There we go. All right. Bye-bye. So, of course, everybody, again, that was author Mark Bacon and his book, Death and Nostalgia City, baconsmysteries.com for more information. And, of course, we're going to recap here and talk about Teresa Argy and Eric Olson. They were on first talking about their book, America's Most Haunted. You can go to americas-most-haunted.com, or you can find them on AM Haunted on Facebook, Twitter, and they have a lot of stuff that they keep themselves going on there. David Bell, you go to David Bell Novels. The book was The Forgotten Girl. And then, of course, we just talked with Mark Bacon. So we want to thank you all again for joining us here. We only have a couple shows left to the end of the year. I believe our season this year ends up on November the 22nd for Suspense Radio. We always like to kind of do it right around Thanksgiving. We kind of take the month of December off to kind of recap, kind of get ourselves together. Think about what we're going to do. We do have, there are some new shows that you're going to hear in 2015. One, I can say, is going to be an art of writing show. It's going to be kind of storytelling. You're going to hear from the authors themselves, big, huge names to just whatever kind. And I'm going, as soon as we get all that done, I will let you know who's going to host that, who's going to star in it. It's someone that you know. And you're going to be talking about that. We're also going to have another one more on the business side of, you know, query writing, how to get published and things like that. And then we're going to do a straight review show on this station. So it's going to be, you know, a bunch of stuff that's going to be coming up here in 2015. Of course, Crime and Science Radio is going to be going on, Suspense Radio and Suspense Radio One-on-One. So a lot of things happening. Go to suspensemagazine.com to find out all the information. We want to thank you all, of course, for listening and joining us each and every week. So until next time, everybody, we'll see you then. Enjoy.